Okay, we're back for episode 128, I think. Joe, how you doing?
I'm doing just fine, Tim. It's been a harrowing couple days with the latest round of Santa Barbara wildfires hitting it, and not at me this time, but at my brother's home. And he spent the night two nights ago here, and we watched on TV, you know, the live feeds to see the fire creep up to his house, and then they stopped it, but it was sort of nerve-wracking. It's just the kind of typical California adventure stuff at this point. You know, we're used to it, but we're all in one piece. And anyway, we're happy to be here. How's everything there in on the East Coast with the Kellys?
Oh, it's we're in seasonal weather here. Got a little warmer this week, but of course we're headed into the holiday season. We're recording early this week because of the holidays. So tonight we agreed to talk about the Moynihan Report. Moynihan Report, official title, is The Negro Family, The Case for National Action. Of course, it was written by Daniel Patrick Moynihan, an American sociologist, then serving as an Assistant Secretary of Labor for the Lyndon B. Johnson administration. Of course, he later became a senator in the 1970s. Moynihan argued that the rise in black single mother families was caused not by lack of jobs, but by a destructive vein in ghetto culture, which could be traced to slavery times and continued discrimination in the American South under Jim Crow. Black sociologist E. Franklin Frazier had introduced that idea in the 1930s. But Moynihan was considered one of the first academics to defy conventional social science wisdom about the structure of poverty. As he wrote later, the work began in the most orthodox setting, the U.S. Department of Labor, to establish that some level of statistical conciseness, what everyone knew, that economic conditions determine social conditions, whereupon it turned out that what everyone knew was exactly not so. That's often the case. In the course of analyzing statistics related to black poverty, Moynihan noticed something unusual. Rates of black male unemployment and welfare enrollment, instead of running parallel, as they always had, started to diverge in 1962 in a way that would come to be called Moynihan's scissors. When Moynihan published his report in 1965, the out-of-wedlock birth rate among blacks was 25%, much higher than that of whites. In the introduction to his report, Moynihan said that the gap between the Negro and most other groups in American society is widening. He also said that the collapse of the nuclear family in the black lower class would preserve the gap between possibilities for Negroes and other groups in favor of other ethnic groups. Moynihan concluded, the steady expansion of welfare programs can be taken as a measure of the steady disintegration of the Negro family structure over the past generation in the United States. More than 30 years later, S. Craig Watkins described Moynihan's conclusions, representing hip-hop culture and the production of black cinema. The report concluded that the structure of family life in the black community constituted a tangle of pathology capable of perpetuating itself without assistance from the white world, and that the heart of the deterioration of the fabric of Negro society is the deterioration of the Negro family. It is the fundamental source of the weakness of the Negro community at the present time. Also, the report argued that the matriarchal structure of black culture weakened the ability of black men to function as authority figures. That particular notion of black familial life has become a widespread, if not dominant, paradigm for comprehending the social economic disintegration of late 20th century black urban life. The Moynihan Report generated considerable controversy, of course, and has had long-lasting influence. Writing to Lyndon Johnson, Moynihan argued that without access to jobs and the means to contribute meaningful support to a family, black men would become systematically alienated from their roles as husbands and fathers, which would cause rates of divorce, child abandonment, out-of-wedlock birth to skyrocket in the black community, a trend that had already begun in the 1960s, leading to vast increases in the numbers of households headed by females and the higher rates of poverty, lower education, educational outcomes, and inflated rates of child abuse that are allegedly associated with these factors. Moynihan made a contemporaneous argument for programs for jobs, vocational training, and educational programs for the black community. From the time of its publication, the report had been sharply attacked by black and civil rights leaders as examples of white patronizing, cultural bias, or racism. At various times, the report had been condemned or dismissed by the NAACP and other civil rights groups and leaders such as Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton. Critics accused Moynihan of relying on stereotypes of the black family and black men, implying that blacks had an inferior academic performance, portrayed crime and pathology as endemic to the black community, and failing to recognize that culture, bias, and racism and standardized tests had contributed to the apparent lower achievements of blacks in school. The report was criticized for threatening to undermine the place of civil rights on the national agenda, leaving a vacuum that could be filled with politics that blamed blacks for their own trouble. In 1987, Hortense Spillers, a black feminist academic, criticized the Moynihan Report on semantic grounds for its use of matriarchy and patriarchy when he described the African American family. She argued that the terminology used to define white families cannot be used to define African American families because of the way slavery had affected black Americans. American economist and writer Walter E. Williams has praised the report for its findings. He also said the solution to major problems that confront many black people won't be found in the political arena, especially not in Washington or state capitals. Thomas Sowell, an African American economist, as well has also praised the Moynihan Report on several occasions. His 1982 book, Race and Economics, mentions the Moynihan Report. And in 1998, he asserted that the report may have been the last honest government report on race. In 2015, Sowell argued that time had proved correct in Moynihan's core idea that African-American poverty was less a result of racism and more of a result of single-parent families. One key fact that keeps getting ignored is that the poverty rate among black married couples has been in single digits every year since 1994. Political commentator Heather McDonald, writing for National Review in 2008, stated, "Conservatives of all stripes routinely praised Daniel Patrick Moynihan's prescience for his warning in 1965 that the breakdown of the black family threatened the achievement of racial equality. They rightly blast those liberals who denounced the Moynihan Report." Psychologist William Ryan coined the phrase blaming the victim in his 1971 book, Blaming the Victim, specifically as a critique of the Moynihan Report. He said that it was an attempt to divert responsibility for poverty, for social structural factors to the behaviors and cultural patterns of the poor. Feminists argued that the Moynihan Report presented a male-centric view of social problems. They believed that Moynihan failed to take into account basic rational incentives for marriage. He did not acknowledge that women had historically engaged in marriage in a part out of need for material resources, as adequate wages were otherwise denied by cultural traditions, excluding women from most jobs outside the home. Get married. Your husband supports you. If you don't have a husband, you have to get a job. That's nothing really to... Anyway, with the expansion of welfare in the U.S. in the mid to late 20th century, women gained better access to government resources intended to reduce family and child poverty. Okay, so they're relying on government to pay for things instead of a husband, okay? Women also increasingly gained access to workplace. That's progress, I suppose. As a result, more women were able to subsist independently when men had difficulty finding work. I guess so much for the children and the young black men without positive male role models. Declaring Moynihan's prophetic Ken Elute in 1982, the underclass proclaimed that one cannot talk about poverty in America or about the underclass without talking about the weakening family structure of the poor. Both the Baltimore Sun and New York Times ran a series on the black family in 1983, followed by a 1985 Newsweek article called Moynihan, I Told You So. In 1986, CBS aired the documentary The Vanishing Black Family, produced by Bill Moyers, a one-time aide to LBJ. He informed Moynihan's findings. In a 2000 interview with PBS, Moynihan said, My view is we had stumbled onto a major social change in the circumstances of postmodern society. It was not long ago in the past society that an anthropologist working in London, a very famous man at the time, Malinowski, postulated what he called the first rule of anthropology, that in all known societies, all male children have an acknowledged male parent. That's what we found out everywhere. And well, maybe it's not true anymore. Human societies change. By the time of that interview, the rate of number of children born to single mothers had gone up in white and Hispanic working classes as well. That's the treatment the Moynihan Report got. It was eventually pretty much turned down by the LBJ administration as they just decided to go through the Great Society and implement welfare programs, transfer programs, these things, and not addressing the crisis in the black family. But of course, if you look at the normalization of illegitimacy, not just in the black community, also in the wider society as well, it's not a hopeful sign. So that's kind of a rundown on the Moynihan Report. Joe, what's your take on this?
The most important aspect of the Moynihan Report is that it was a completely different technique of social improvement than what was in mind from the oligarchs. What the Moynihan Report was actually advocating and would have led to would have been giving money to families that were intact. In other words, where you had a father, a mother living in a single residence. This was really the revolutionary concept that Moynihan was leading up to. It isn't stated anywhere in the report, but you can see that that was just would have been a very, very natural follow-up from what he was saying. So what was in mind for America was social policy that would destroy the family, right? Now this becomes the Great Society program where money is given to women only if they are living alone, if they are not in an intact family. Intact families were at a disadvantage in terms of the welfare check as it was set up in the Great Society. So this was why the Moynihan Report, while it was given lip service by people that Moynihan showed it to, everyone said that, oh, gee, this is a great idea. When it came time for policy, it was basically shunted aside. And what they did was they had a whole litany of basically intellectuals, psychologists, theologians, and they attacked it from different perspectives. The E. Michael Jones wrote what I think is just a great article in Culture Wars. I think it was in 1995, and he outlined basically the attack that came at Moynihan when he brought his revolutionary idea of giving money as a way to basically encourage people to stay together as a family. E. Michael Jones covers it very well, and he points out that if you just kind of go through the press at the time, you can see that Paul Tillich, Jack Kerouac, and from there, just all sorts of artists and people who are influential in the media are all taking the position that first of all, that sexual liberation is basically a hard-won right, so that this is part of what the Great Society is evidently, why it's attractive to the left is that the woman is not required to have a monogamous relationship. Right. And so in that vein, E. Michael Jones' Brinkman Report. But he also shows that there was a theological vein. It wasn't just kind of the hip artists, it wasn't just the pseudopsychologists, but there was actually people who were, claiming that there was like a religious context, this kind of New Age Christianity that was emerging, and this was really led by Paul Tillich. And so in E. Michael Jones' articles, he goes into Tillich quite a bit, and I was fascinated by this because Tillich is such an interesting character and so important to understand, and the fact that he intersected so directly the Moynihan Report and was actually the part of the bulwark against it is something that I think people should be, aware of, like his background and who he was influencing and where his stuff, what his stuff really means. And I just wanted to point out that Tillich is the guy who in Frankfurt arranged, well, first of all, he oversaw Adorno's doctoral thesis. So he was his, PhD mentor. And he also arranged for Horkheimer, another person who ends up writing The Authoritarian Personality, to be made a dean at the university in Germany. And then Tillich comes to the United States and he takes up basically, he is in physical contact with Horkheimer and Adorno right up to the point where they go off to write The Authoritarian Personality. And so this is a guy who is supposedly a Lutheran minister, and yet he has a theology that is based on basically the kind of religious importance of sexual liberation. And what you really got to understand about Tillich, because he was, it's hard to kind of get a grip on because his work is sort of arcane and it's in some cases, and I think it's actually hidden because they don't really want people to know much about it at this point. But his wife wrote a memoir, and that was called From Time to Time. And here you get to see what really is going on. And what was amazing to me is that Tillich and his wife would go into Harlem and they would go to these black sex clubs where sex would be going on, just basically kind of like in a swinging, sense, right? And this was to Tillich basically kind of the direction of that theology needed to go. That this was really what kind of what's called liberation theology. If you ever heard the expression, this was actually what Tillich had in mind for it. And so that's when and so when you see kind of the underpinnings of like Tillich's philosophy, and you can see that it's absolutely bold-faced degeneracy. I mean, I won't go into some of the stuff that Tillich's wife brings out, but Tillich was ra there were, people were shocked when this came out. They didn't quite understand, how it could fit into all these fancy words Tillich came up with about this new idea of God and all the stuff about liberation and emancipation that he was bringing up. But it really kind of helps, I think, people understand sort of the malevolence and the kind of unseen aspect of what Moynihan was fighting against, because the idea of sexual emancipation, which is basically to say, no moral perspective on sexuality. There's no monogamy that's promoted. There's no moral advantage to to a family. It is just sexuality is an important existential right, and so we have to just obtain it whenever we can, and it's just something that's it's just good in and of itself. I mean, this really goes back, at least as you probably further, but you can certainly See it in the Hungarian Soviet with Gregor Lukács, where he has the degenerate sex education for children. This was, 30 years before Tillich's forays into the sex clubs in Harlem. But Lukács then goes on to found the Frankfurt School, which then completely comes under the kind of, or at least so many of the members are in contact with Tillich before they move out to New York and then on to California. So it's this very important circle, very small intellectual circle that then creates the authoritarian personality, which talks about Eros as propaganda. And my point is, sorry to be long-winded, but it's just that what Moynihan had stepped into was basically the organized structure of sexual degeneracy that was going to be, put on top of culture. All of the people that he was basically, amazed that were fighting against him in different ways, they aren't kind of random perspectives. It isn't just art and philosophy and psychology and sociology and theology. They're all organized. They all are bringing sophistry. These are the arguments that these people are bringing to justify this is just there to hide, to camouflage what they're really trying to do, which is if you look at the statistics of, like even in Wikipedia on non-marital birth rates, you can see that this is obviously the social a goal. I mean, every single ethnic group as soon as the Great Society programs come into effect, the non-marital birth rates just go right through the roof. And so this is not circumstance. This is an agenda. Moynihan was clear-minded. He was absolutely right. But he was dealing with people involved, it's like I say about, the political world in general. Try not to get too caught up in the drama of the puppets. Look for the strings. I think Moynihan, he didn't understand that a lot of the people he was dealing with were just part of the project, and they were just basically giving him, a storyline to keep him at bay until they could get their social agenda in place.
Yeah, like so many people, even today, but even then, particularly then, there's no cognizance of covert psychological warfare.
Right.
What happened, you had the idea of the Moynihan Report was supporting, the black family by helping the heads of black, the other black family, meaning the males, the fathers. And supporting the family meant reversing the sexual revolution, which at the time, as you allude to, was being supported by, all the media, think tanks, universities, literati, the culture elite, these things. So that was the agenda. And they didn't want to, again, surrender those, what they perceive as hard-won rights. You mentioned the idea of liberation, sexual emancipation, along with political emancipation. That sociologist Fraser, that he, writing in the 30s, had talked about. Michael Jones talks about this in the article, how this kind of conflicts with the official narrative of the civil rights movement and the pro freedom agenda, or liberation, or is that when the blacks migrated north into the cities, they were freed from the constraints of the South, the rural South. And that led to some of this alienation, also sort of, they no longer had any guidance anymore. And Fraser follows us back to the emancipation era and how those blacks that weren't tied to family had a lot of difficulties. Those that had structural families did well, even in the Jim Crow era. They were able to survive and actually do pretty well in relative terms. And so it was that, again, it was that familiar family structure that was key. It is interesting that you have that one I think it was McKissick, who said that Daniel Patrick Moynihan assumes that every family should be the same. You know, but there are consequences to, you know, to your family structure and how you live, and you know, there are better ways to raise people, and there's worse ways to raise people and the cope in modern society. And you know, you could, one of the claims of the civil rights movement was not only just political emancipation, but also social mobility uplift, i.e. creating a large black middle class. Well, things, you can't have a black middle class without middle class values, so you can't spurn middle class values and expect to have a large black middle class. And that's what they wanted. And again, that would have supporting a strong family meant supporting traditional morality, especially regarding sex. And they didn't want to give that up. So yeah, he came into conflict with those forces. What Moynihan was going against, and what the Johnson administration initially ran into, was the basically the forces that were behind the civil rights movement. And this is how we get into what was the civil rights movement. You know, if you look in the 1960s, the civil rights movement, the LBJ administration allied itself with it. Of course, remember that he's elected in a landslide in 1964. It's a year after Kennedy's assassinated. But he slowly became alienated from the civil rights movement. Basically, LBJ took a very cynical view of this. All they're good for is asking for more money, and that's it. They wanted handouts, he said. But really, by 1964, though, politically, the civil rights movement, 64, 65, they had won. They'd gotten the Civil Rights Act passed. You know, the Voting Rights Act was going to be passed. So there wasn't much more politically that could be achieved. So they were kind of at a crossroads. But at the same time, 1965, I think you had the riots in Watts out west. And a lot of people were taken aback by this, because this is at a time when all this legislation is being passed, these programs are being implemented. Perhaps expectations were too high. Nevertheless, you had these riots. And this was going to challenge the narrative that had been pushed by the media since the late 50s of sort of this noble Southern Negro and his quest for political equality. Now you had this violent Northern Negro, who penchant for crime and violence. And, you know, and it was a question of trying to keep things from boiling over. And of course, it was in the 60s that the black crime rate started to explode, along with the illegitimacy rate. So that's the backdrop of this. Let's look at the 1960s in general. This is the heyday of the new economics, you know, and we're into almost the 20th year of post-war prosperity. I guess those in charge thought they had mastered the economy with Keynesian fine tuning, and you know, it was basically Office of Management and Budget. Had forecast of more than enough revenue. Of course, this is before the Vietnam War was escalated, and that would change a lot too. So that's the context for this. But this again, this sociologist E. Franklin Frazier talks about, you know, the dangerous sexual patterns of blacks, particularly black men in the South who were unrooted. And again, those that were within an intact family did well, but those who weren't had problems. And so it was essential to establishing some sort of family structure for blacks for them to be able to do well in American society. And this is what Daniel Patrick Moynihan noticed. And this would seem to be the case, because late 40s into the 50s, large sections of the black community were doing much better. And of course, if you look at the illegitimacy, you look at the charts, in the late 40s and 50s, they are parallel with overall society, the white society. And they started to diverge in the 60s. Why is this? You know, and you mentioned there was this was the beginning of the sexual revolution, which wasn't organic or just by accident. This was being engineered from above. And that's what Eco Michael Jones talks about in the article, running into these forces. The Negro as a proxy for a political revolution, sexual revolution, had been supported for a very long time, particularly by the Jews. And this was used, Negroes have been used for mass migration, integration to break up the Catholic urban neighborhoods in the North. And this would again facilitate the sexual revolution for the society at large, because once the Catholics were uprooted and sent into suburbia, they could be corrupted by popular culture, which were controlled by who? At the same time, the idea, again, you talked about Jack Kerouac, Norman Mailer's concept of the white Negro. Using the arts and music and literature to promote the Negro as sexual revolutionary. There's something exciting and special about the Negro. He was free from all this. I think it was Kerouac who called it spade kicks. And, you know, I guess from the standpoint of the whites looking, you know, venturing into Harlem every so often, looking from afar, it is exciting, but it isn't very good for the black, for black children particularly. But again, this is the type of the image that was celebrated. E. Michael Jones wrote another article about black exploitation films. And this, again, this people don't realize, but what he uncovered, and at least what he writes about, is that movies like Superfly, and what was the other one? Richard Roundtree?
Shaft.
They were directed by Gordon Parks. Gordon Parks was a photographer for Time Life. Time Life is the propaganda ministry for the CIA. It's, you know, that's Henry Luce. We did a show on that and the connection between Time Life and CIA and basically the American elite. And he had been hired, first brought in by the CIA and the FBI to infiltrate the Black Panthers and also the Nation of Islam, because they accepted him into their grouping because he was black. And he was able to go and identify the leaders and give the layout to their apartment, so when time came, they could be assassinated, I suppose. You know, this is... and Gordon Parks was commissioned by MGM, who was led by James Aubrey, I think, at the time. And these films were produced in the 1970s. This is in the advent of the collapse of the so-called Black Jewish Alliance. Now, Black Jewish Alliance, you tend to think that's sort of like, you know, they're working together. What happened was the blacks were the front guys and the Jews ran the show. What they didn't like was the blacks started to get uppity in the mid-late 60s, and that's when the alliance collapsed. It came to a head with the teacher strike in New York City in 1967. Harold Cruz wrote a book about this, I believe, then at the time. So almost out of retribution, active retribution, and also just to further corrupt what remained of, you know, of the black community, they had Hollywood producing these films. So no longer, you know, in the 1960s, the people like the Black Panthers were supported by the Jews to support the idea of the Black Revolutionary. Stokely Carmichael. You know, who's the, you know, the guy who wrote Soul on Ice?
That's Eldridge Cleaver.
Eldridge Cleaver, Huey Newton, these characters. And this was the Black Revolutionary. But in the 1970s, it was going to be the Black Pimp. And this was supported in these movies like Superfly. And again, this was done in conjunction with Time Life, MGM, the CIA. You know,
you can really see how the evil and also the plan when you compare Frazier, the black sociologist, writing with Kerouac. Mm-hmm. Frazier, you know, he wrote the book The Negro Family in the United States that Moynihan drew on, and he wrote that I can actually quote him. He said that in the new environment, the Negro's sexual impulses were liberated from group control. Mm-hmm. The new environment. And became subject only to the external control of the master. In other words, by the new environment, you're talking about the slavery. Mm-hmm. So he says that, and the wishes and attitude of those whom he formed unions, when the sexual impulses of the males were no longer control slaves, their customs and mores were also destroyed. And so he says they became the subject only to periodic urge of sexual hunger. In other words, sexuality is always an aspect of culture. Mm-hmm. And when culture is completely shattered, then sexuality remains, but it's a loose cannon. It's not really, you know, it doesn't have any structure in terms of the social good. And so then Frazier went on and he said, when the yoke of slavery was lifted, so, you know, he's drawing a broad stroke. He says the drifting masses were left without any restraints upon their vagrant impulses and wild desires. The old intimacy between master and slave, upon which the moral order under the slave regime had rested, was destroyed forever. Promiscuous sexual relations and constant changing of spouses became the rule with the demoralized elements in the freed Negro population. Okay, so Frazier's looking at basically African-American culture at the turn of the 19th century, and he's basically talking about the misery and the political impotence, right, that the lack of families has left the African American community to suffer with, right? Mm-hmm. So it's negative, it's completely negative. But then when you look at Kerouac's vision of that same phenomena, he talks about how exciting it is, how it's like liberating, and that that it's basically the you know, it is an antidote to oppressive Christian sexual morality.
Yeah, yeah.
The Negro, as seen through, you know, Mailer and Kerouac, is basically an alternative gospel. So that, as Kerouac says, ecstasy, joy, kicks, darkness, and music. Now think about this. Think about how is it possible that someone as intimately understanding of the black culture as Frazier, who is black, who grew up in it, who knows everybody there, has a completely different perspective than these dilettantes who are nibbling at just these particular apps. See, so it's really quite amazing, and
but they're just you're young men who want to get laid.
Yeah, and the thing is that, but now the media then, well, who becomes the voice that actually lets the white middle class know about what's going on inside the African American culture? Frazier isn't heard.
No,
you know, the real voice of like, we need help here. We have basically had our culture shattered twice now within 100 years, or, you know, 200 years, where we were enslaved, and then the condition of slavery that we lived in and became accustomed to, then that was taken away from us. Now, where are we as human beings? Where are we as elements of a culture? Where is our culture? And that's why, in my mind, it is so absolutely heroic and so indicative of really what the African Americans can achieve when you look at the statistics from the end of the 19th century. I mean, in that period before the Great Society takes hold, that they actually had suddenly had been able to organize themselves to the extent that the family was coming back into existence. Mm-hmm. Their rates of illegitimacy were still higher, but they were tracking toward. Just amazing. Think about how incredible that is. Think about what they were facing as a culture. And yet, in spite of that, they were actually tracking toward the out of birth rates of a culture as having as many benefits and long standing structural support as white middle class, right? It's extraordinary. And so I think that's exactly why they hit him at that time. They knew that they had to act quickly. I think that's really why they rushed into the Great Society programs, is because they wanted to use the sexuality that was without culture, that had been in place in the African American communities following the end of slavery. They wanted to use that in the way that Mailer and Kerouac and Tillich were you know, basically trying to give to the middle class. They wanted to use that basically that sexual perspective without culture and to give it to the white middle class as something that was, they could call, liberation.
Well, that popular culture would do much of that work. Yeah,
exactly.
Rock and roll music. Yeah, I mean,
yeah, and then, of course, and now the music. Yeah. So now suddenly when you look at it in that way, America makes perfect sense. You can see how we got to where we are now and what was in back of everything.
And they bought out the official leader. I mean, obviously, the way to control the opposition, you know, is obviously, the best way to handle opposition is to control it. And the entire civil rights establishment was corrupted and controlled, you know, whether it's Jesse Jackson or Al Sharpton, who's an FBI informant, or Martin Luther King, who was completely sexually compromised, and you know, and the Urban League itself, you know, got bought into abortion and contraceptives and rejected the Moynihan's plan, you know, to promoting families, and the leadership itself bought into abortion and birth control to actually reduce their ranks, as opposed to Moynihan Plan, which would have produced a stable, you know, a stable black community, which didn't, you know, forever have its hand extended out.
Yeah, amazing. And when you think about the actual factual statistics now, where you're up to 80% of out of wedlock births, and higher in some areas.
I mean, that's nationwide in the urban. It's 100% more or less in this close to it.
So that now you can see, I mean, there isn't any question but that Moynihan was right. The Moynihan report, with you cannot argue any other way. It was the right path.
As that feminist said, it enforced patriarchy, and it kept women down because all women want to go and have jobs, right?
Yeah, they all just can't wait to get into the workplace.
Yeah.
So the whole.
I mean, there was what that article was it feminist Ms. Magazine with Michelle.
The myth of the superwoman, Black Macho, written by Michelle Wallace, and then it turned out to be actually written by Kerouac's girlfriend Johnson. I mean, the whole thing was just.
Yeah.
I mean, Ms. Magazine is another good portal to understand the world through, because you can see that legitimate feminism, which was economic, was wiped out and replaced by the anti-family feminism that Gloria Steinem was all about. Mm-hmm. And part of that was to continue the process by which the black family would disintegrate. They knew they had with the blacks, you know, if you read it, like E. Michael Jones talks about it in his article, that there was this idea of white guilt. There was this idea of the kind of like we really have to go out of our way to be loving toward blacks. Martin Luther King talks about the beloved community, which is basically the integrated community. And so with that social pressure, now how do you actually say to them, well, I'm sorry, but your sexuality is immoral and it's destructive.
Yeah, you're blaming the victim, yeah.
Exactly. So that the way that the intellectual kind of, you know, pieces were put together, the white middle class couldn't be in any kind of a leadership role at all.
And he points out in the article that much of that is, well, again, to go back to sexual liberation, I think it was Michael Harrington, who wrote The Other America, said that everyone was out getting laid. And so you had the sexual corruption. But he says the guilt that comes from that sexual corruption, the psychological effect is people, you want to address that guilt in social activism. And so it's okay if you're out fornicating, if you recycle and you support civil rights or the peace movement and these things. And so that's how it kind of manifests itself in these movements. So, you know, that's why, and they don't want to give up, you know, sexual liberation. And, you know, so they try to make up for it in other things. And that's in his article, he writes that white guilt was more of a liberal phenomenon. You certainly didn't have white guilt in the South in these things. Again, it was one of these things where you had a certain agenda and your certain social agenda, and this was sexual liberation. And, of course, we've also talked about, and it's been documented, that in a way the black family was targeted more directly. It was more vulnerable, easier to smash. But, you know, so in the process of promoting the civil rights and it's promoting Negro influence and culture, usually backed by Jewish cultural makers or with entertainment and these things, they would have a deleterious effect on white morality in the white community. And this was...
Integration
was a big part of that. But I mean, you had the Planned Parenthood meeting in Pennsylvania in 1969, you know, the Jaffe report, where they talk about, you know, ultimately for the purpose of reducing the population, destroying the family by promoting sexual degenerate behavior.
You know? Yeah. I mean, they created weaponized integration.
There's a recent article. Have you heard about that No Nut November?
No.
Basically, men have forswore pornography.
Oh, good for them.
And there was an article that was cited to me that said that that lack of masturbation leads to authoritarian impulses. And the funny thing about that is I want to laugh at that.
Tim, is that the M scale?
The M scale. Basically, if you don't masturbate, you might become a fascist.
Yeah,
which is, again, yeah, well, it's laughable, but in a way it isn't. There's an understanding of psychology there. That's like the authoritarian personality, basically traditional morality, father leading, being the provider, protector of the family. This creates the fascism, the F scale, right?
Yeah. So, but just remember when this is fascinating to me that E. Michael Jones picked up on Tillich and how he was really very instrumental in this.
But his guilt too. He's just trying to rationalize his own degenerate behavior, make it sound,
But remember,
profound or something.
It's part of the Frankfurt School.
Yeah, you're right.
He is completely involved with Horkheimer and Adorno 20 years before they write The Authoritarian Personality.
Yeah, which
So the thing is, when you look at The Authoritarian Personality, this isn't a scheme that they hatched in like 1945 through 1950. I mean, this is long standing. This is sexual degeneracy as a way to destroy the family and then make the culture able to be conquered. I mean, this is long standing, mm-hmm. this plan. And so when you get to, the Moynihan report, and then you find that, he's got this clear-minded, with an idea with a lot of statistics backing it up, but they're standing between him and the social policy. Suddenly you've got Jack Kerouac and Paul Tillich. But wait, Tillich is part of the Frankfurt School. This is going to become the authoritarian personality where they're going to say, in order to avoid fascism and authoritarian personalities, we've got to use Eros as propaganda. Mm-hmm. Okay. And we've got to use it again on a mass scale against European culture. That's just when, not stated precisely, but that's exactly what the chapter 23, the conclusions basically says. Just, we're going to go after the culture. We're going to use propaganda. It's going to be Eros. And so now when you get to Tillich and Adorno and Horkheimer and all these Masons and Jewish pseudo-psychologists, well, it's how clear can it be? I mean, they have this idea. It goes all the way back to Marx, but certainly Freud. When you look at Freud and his idea of, there's neurosis. We've got to liberate sexuality in order to get that tension out of there. I mean, it's all working together. There's no way this could be circumstantial because, Tim, the idea is completely crackpot. The idea that, the religious idea that the sexual degeneracy that Tillich is living is some kind of the emancipation theology? Really?
Yeah.
I mean, this is just a stupid, it's just, if you just take it as an idea, as a theological concept, it's so stupid. I mean, it's not even worthy of like a teenager, on marijuana. It's so stupid, but it is actually being sold as part of all of these different supporting aspects of basically taking the European culture off a cliff in terms of sexual degeneracy.
Yeah, and of course, Moynihan's an interesting figure because, of course, he's Catholic, Irish Catholic.
Yeah.
And he grew up in Hell's Kitchen. And one of the critics says, well, everyone assumes, Moynihan assumes everyone should have a family like him, assuming his family was intact. Actually, he came from a broken family, just that he was aware of Catholic social teachings, and put particularly, Leo XIII's encyclical on this. And, Catholic social teachings has a particular, I think important insight in these affairs, in these matters, because it cites one of the principles of subsidiarity. It has to, you want to take care of things at the most local level. And you can't get anything more local than the family. And he said, pretty much, the family is a miniature society. And you can't, if you have chaos in that miniature society, you have chaos in the wider society. And so you have to address that. That's what Moynihan was aware of. And that was his key insight in that. And you can't expect any progress, despite how many programs, how much money you pour into these things. In fact, these programs actually have an opposite effect. Intentionally so, at least, ultimately. But you can't expect have so much internal chaos in a community with broken families and kids without fathers, without any discipline or anything like that, and expect that society to progress in any way other than what these programs create by promoting sexual degenerate and sexual responsible behavior is a lumpen proletariat, a class that's simply no good for anything other than making trouble, in which then that has been instrumentalized. I mean, good example is, you know, black rioting. These can be used a lot of things for promoting the police state or chasing people out of neighborhoods, creating white flight, or just creating certain optics you may want for political reasons. And that's, you know, these things have, you know, look at today's Black Lives Matter today and these things, these, you know, the riots that are created, whether it's Ferguson or something like that. That was the key insight into this, that basically you really can't have these broad programs, grand vision of things if, you know, the community isn't forming at all because there's no family. You can't have a family. You can't have a community without a family. And he was aware of that, of these things, you know.
Yeah. And so anyway, it's just been such a dramatic transition of culture. And I wanted to read, I think it's Rollo Mays. Rollo May. I mean, he's someone who came under Tillich's sway. And the reason I want to read the statement is kind of a little bit long, but I thought it really is. It's fascinating in that I think it's legitimate. I think May may have actually just lost his mind, like so many people did, basically, like all of my friends and me, you know, who were given the sexual emancipation as this like noble event that was going to, you know, free mankind or something, you know. So this is the thing, is that you have useful idiots that take up the activity once you get the concept is given to them. And so May, who had been, you know, kind of a normal psychologist, he wrote that he says he fell under Tillich's tutelages. And he said that Paul's statement took away my security, that childish belief to which, against all intellectual development, I apparently still clung. I knew that God, for most people, was not the guarantor of the status quo. He protected them from fundamental upset, from moral anarchy. God guarded the sanctity of marriage. He was against crime. He protected property, especially if you belonged to one of those sects sprang from Calvinism. The word atheist conjured up all the opposite things: a satanic person who is anti-moral, who believes in free love, who is dishonest and would torture your grandmother, plus all the invective hurled at the atheistic communism in our day. Infantile as were these vestigial remnants of my early imprinting, and outrageous to my reason as they still are, I cannot deny that they existed somewhere in my consciousness. It required not logic, but living, and time to mature beyond such superstitions. It also required living and time to absorb what Paul was trying to say. So, I mean, May just describes basically that, you know, the theology that Tillich promoted took him completely away from any religious belief and any kind of moral convention whatsoever. And this was a thing, right? But isn't it amazing that he could even make a statement like this, that without seeing that, you know, it's completely incoherent? If he is supposedly, you know, operating as someone who in this case is someone, he made this at the Union Theological Seminary when he was talking about, the kind of existential theology, right? It's a religious perspective. And yet really what it is, it's just an excuse for degeneracy. But he says it required not logic. Right. Well, that's right, because the logic isn't going to help you there, buddy, because you're completely opposing all it. But just living to mature beyond such superstition. So here is the cutting edge, where critical theory has been able to, using theology and pseudo-psychological techniques like, the authoritarian personality, the F-scale, Freudianism, you know. They're all working together here, and May now is taking the position that, forget logic, forget God, forget all of my, kind of structure of civilization. I'm just going to have a great time now because I have absorbed what Tillich was telling me.
Yeah, It's a black op against Christian society, which is ultimately a black op against European culture, because Christendom and Europe are the same thing.
Well, it leads us to genocide. You see, the problem is, like I've said 100 times, I'm like really not a very religious person. I mean, I wrote Caesar's Messiah, so you can think about religion as propaganda. However, we need to have a culture in order to keep ourselves strong and be able to defend ourselves against people who attack us, right?
Well, didn't Freud say he was a latter-day Hannibal assaulting
exactly right.
the gates of Rome?
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And so the thing is that the values that, you know, when you think about what religion is, I mean, it's just a way of, in one sense, I mean, I'm just trying to abstract it from the purely theological and relationship to God aspect, but religion and the morality that it produces, this is just helping people move toward positions of strength and health. You see,
Joe, lighten up, man. Loosen up, man. How do you rock and roll with an attitude like that?
You know.
How do you get down?
Well, you know, what can I say, man? I live in Santa Barbara, and here, I mean, our biggest kind of cultural pride is in neurodiversity. I mean, that's what we're able to produce here is neurodiversity. We have it's just some of the dumbest people you've ever seen in your life, you know, and. Unfortunately, you know, it's now becoming something that people are proud of almost, you know, it's just so sad to see.
Well, with the article, again, he says what happened as E. Michael Jones says that is that Moynihan and the LBJ administration had come against the forces that were behind the civil rights movement. How these movements, they have a hidden grammar to them, those ulterior motives, and whether it's a political or a cultural movement like the civil rights movement, or popular music, you know, these iconic figures were given, the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, you know, disco and these things, you know, the movies that are being created, and you can do the history and find out how these movies became, I guess, more effective weapons because the barriers or constraints were gradually removed under the guise of liberty, you know, like freedom of speech protection. First Amendment was extended to obscenity. When in the past, obscenity was controlled by local police powers and local values and these things. But when, you know, they said, well, this is, if it's free speech has redeeming parts to it, then you can't ban it because it's free speech. At the same time, they're also foreclosing on and limiting actual political free speech. That's which is kind of funny. But again, well, you know, these things, these culture figures, these agents of change or of societal dissolution of people, whether it's, you know, iconic popular music or popular entertainment figures or political figures like a Gloria Steinem, you know, or Alex, you know, or Ginsburg and these characters, you know, they're all propped up to achieve this thing. And the entire structure of corporate America, be it, you know, the news media, entertainment, they promoted these people. That's why we know who they are, you know.
That's exactly right. Is that the celebrity is almost always a stamp of you know, that indicates that the individual is basically promoted by you know, the brave new world oligarchs, you know. Mm-hmm. This is how celebrities come about. And I would say, I don't know, it's hard to say. I mean, I'm sure there are some that are not, but in general, there is a constant promotion of you know, of individuals that they can count on to deliver the right kind of message.
Well, look at it like I look at this type of cultural or, you know, covert psychological warfare or cultural warfare is it's almost like biological warfare is once you release the agent, there'll be people who become carriers of it who won't be conscious agents of it, but they're carrying it. You know, and so that's the same thing with culture. You know, you can just let it out there; it'll spread by itself.
And when you see that this evil, just as kind of, you know, just wanted to die, just to go into a more cheerful perspective. When you see this evil, I mean, just think of how evil they had to be. I mean, evil in the sense of I define that as meaning that they look at these classes of humans, the group that they are going to integrate, the blacks and the white middle class, as bugs. I mean, they have just not one iota of empathy in terms of humanity. So this group sees themselves as completely distinct and able to basically wipe them out and create this kind of misery, mm-hmm. right? Because think of it, it's not just murder. I mean, they're as murderous as anything imaginable. But think of the misery in the inner city that they've created. I mean, it's just unbelievable when you think about this. Tens of millions of people who have lived in poverty without family in a world where drugs are the only way they can make a living selling these things, where the prison basically has replaced the school. I mean, to have created that deliberately is just absolutely incredible. And so that's why when I say, look, you've got to, be concerned about, vaccination and all of the different things and the drugs, because the Brave New World, the idea of creating a neurodiverse society, I mean, people may think it's far-fetched, but man, I don't think it's far-fetched at all. I think it's just inevitable because it's really the only way they can protect themselves. Because here's the problem. As this is becoming, more and more people are becoming aware that something is occurring, right? That some power is manipulating the entire human world. And it has with the idea of genocide and dictatorship. They're going to start responding. And so that's why they need to, the way they can avoid any kind of problem is with through neurodiversity in quotes, right? Mm-hmm. They have to just start dumbing down the groups that would naturally rebel against them.
Then you can do that with any form of introduction of toxins, which you can do easily with a needle, yeah. or with the food supply and these things. Yeah,
that's why to me the rebellion starts out with individual health.
Well, the biggest thing is in terms of a consciousness is. Something like the knowledge or the understanding of sexual liberation as covert political control. Once you're aware of that, the spell wears off.
Exactly.
That's the important thing.
Yeah. That's exactly right. If you know that it's there to damage you, you're going to have some capacity to resist it. I mean, the world is so pornographic at this point for males, right? With the internet and with TV and with just the way that sexuality is constantly being bombarded. Into their minds, it's very distracting. It'll keep, of course, them from making any direction toward family production, real family production. But if you just have that awareness, if you just know that this is deliberate and it's there to damage you, from keep you from actually realizing a real life, realizing a world, a self that you were. Came from and designed to be most comfortable within. Yeah, man, you can get rid of this stuff. It doesn't have to be a catastrophe in your own world, in your own life. You can fight against it.
Yes. I guess to close it out, I guess I'll read the final paragraph in Jones's article.
Sure.
It's when Undersecretary Moynihan proposed the choice between a cure based on a reform of morals and further decay, the left chose decay as a way of saving the sexual revolution. In the 20 years since the left made that decision, illegitimacy among all blacks has gone from 20% to more than 67%. The situation, which Moynihan described as an epidemic for blacks in 1965, has become the norm for white society, which now has an illegitimacy rate of 21%. Black leadership, deeply compromised sexually as well, acquiesced in that choice. Rather than give up their stake in the sexual revolution, they chose to condemn the black underclass to a prolonged term in the ghetto. Averting their eyes from family pathology, they chose to see white racism as a radix malorum. Even the blacks, who are the beneficiaries of the liberal conscious money that affirmative action has become, seem mired in self-defeating and self-conferred image of themselves as helpless victims. Then as now, nobody wants to hear that perfecting the social order will be of no avail without a reform of conduct.
Yeah, well said. I would just say that, unfortunately, you have to add to that awareness of the deliberate plan of destruction. Yeah. Because if you don't have it, it's going to be tough to... I mean, I really think that idea is so radical that it has the power to cut through the absolute, devastation in the inner city. If the awareness that this was done deliberately takes hold, that will provide the grit to be able to raise themselves out of it. But yeah, and that was written in 1995.
Yes.
And I just think it's absolutely clear-minded. I'm glad that that there was someone in 95 who was able to write so clearly. It's actually kind of almost sad, because when you think of where the illegitimacy rates have gone since 95,
they've gotten worse.
That's
that's
almost like platonic. So anyway, wow, good show, Tim. Let's have a happy Thanksgiving.
Oh, you too.
And we will get them next week, okay?
Yep. Enjoy Thanksgiving. We'll be with us next week.
Be in touch. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We'll be right back.